I am pleased to introduce our guest speaker today. Reverend Turner, Reverend Joe Turner, is a Shin Buddhist minister. He's also the board member of Orange County Buddhist Church, and we are very glad that he will be spending time with us today. Would you please welcome Reverend Turner?
Good morning. My talk is titled Approaching Buddhism as a Modern Convert. And I chose the word approaching because it's very difficult in the West to appreciate or approach or engage Buddhism within a Buddhist context. A lot of Buddhism gets appropriated selectively. Bits are selectively chosen and overemphasized in popular culture. And it makes it very difficult for new people to appreciate Buddhism. And that's kind of what I would like to talk about today. So I don't focus so much on trying to explain all the minutiae and all the details of Buddhism to new people. I think it's more effective to kind of try to explain the religious context, the questions Buddhism's trying to answer, its frame of reference. It's not that it's better than Christianity or Judaism or Islam. It's just different. It comes from an Indian religious sensitivity, and it's just different. And if you try to understand it with a Western scientific Christian mind, and we all have that. But whether we're Christian or not, we have that frame of reference. It's difficult to understand what's going on in a Buddhist temple. I started attending the Orange County Buddhist Church 11 years ago with my wife and family. It's a Japanese school of Buddhism. And Buddhists struggle with that word. School is pretty good. Sect isn't such a good word. Denomination, they're not like Protestant denominations. One scholar now is saying it's more like branches in a tree. So one analogy I use a lot is Derek Fisher, almost left the Lakers, who used a triangle offense, and he almost went to the Boston Celtics this month. But luckily the Lakers got him back again. But he can do that because basketball is basketball. And even though he knows the triangle, he could easily adapt. It's the same skill set. He could easily play for the Celtics, even though it would break our hearts. The different schools of Buddhism are a little bit like that. They're a different flavor. They emphasize different things. But the basic understanding and the basic goal of Buddhism is agreed upon. It's the process of how we get there. So different schools have different practices or different paths. And a lot of it has to do with the intended audience. So the school of Buddhism that I belong to is called, these are technical terms, but it's called Pure Land Buddhism. And Pure Land Buddhism traditionally is aimed at ordinary, everyday, working people and family. So at our temple, there's grandparents, grandchildren, adults, there's crying babies. It's a non-monastic form of Buddhism. So the chanting, the rituals, the sermons, the bar is very low so that people on their first day would be able to chant and be able to understand the talk. So we actually try to give a Dharma talk to an eight-year-old, and we figure if the eight-year-old gets it, then everyone will understand it. Okay. So I am what is called by scholars a modern Buddhist convert. And Buddhists don't really like this term too much because of the word convert. There's not really a strict conversion going on, and I'll discuss why that is. But I grew up a Western scientific person. I have degrees from UCLA in mathematics and computer science. I'm not a New Age, warm and fuzzy, artistic type person. I'm scientific. I'm cynical. I'm scientific. I have a Methodist and Lutheran background when I was a child. And in high school, I got very into Christianity. And I kind of thought in my mind that if I practiced morals and ethics very hard, that would somehow give me maybe more purity, or I'd be more worthy of salvation. So that was kind of the religious model I had in high school. And I found that as I became more moral and ethically oriented, I started to I started to judge people more, and my circle of friends got smaller and smaller and smaller. And I also got more angry. First, I got rid of all my friends that smoked cigarettes or ever had a beer. And then I started getting rid of friends who had friends that whoever smoked or had a beer. And I started to realize that the Ten Commandments are relatively easy to follow when you're 14 years old. Because, you know, it said not to covet your neighbor's wife. I mean, I was 14 and she was 50. I thought, okay, that's easy. But what I found is the more I focused on morals and ethics, I realized physically I wasn't doing anything wrong. But mentally, I still had those thoughts. So I noticed the more I practiced, I almost seemed to find more junk going on in my head the more I practiced, the more aware I became of all the things I wanted to say or I wanted to do, but I stopped myself. So like they say in Meet the Falkers, my circle of trust got smaller and smaller and smaller, and I became very lonely, and I finally just abandoned religion altogether. And it just wasn't working for me. And I think if I had a really good minister, Christian minister, that could have explained to me what was going on, I mean, I was very idealistic as a 14-year-old, maybe that would have helped. But instead, I decided to follow in mathematics. Mathematicians believe that real truth lies in mathematics. I mean, we think mathematics is superior over all other disciplines. And it's kind of a long story, but from the time I was 14 to the time I was 38, I was seeking something. First through morals and ethics, then through mathematics. Then I thought, well, I'll get a job and I'll find peace. I'll make money. I'll be successful. Then I thought if I got married, maybe that would quench this thirst I have. And when I tell this story in front of my wife, I have to be very careful. But I got married and I was very happy, but there was still something missing. I still felt like there was something more to life. There's something not quite right. And then I had children, and I thought that would take care of everything, and it didn't. I'm an extremist. Then I started playing guitar a lot, and I took guitar lessons. This is over like a 30-year period. I started to play guitar a lot, and I found that while I was playing guitar, I was very calm and very relaxed. But then when I stopped playing guitar, this sense of unease came back. And then I started long-distance running. And I actually ran 3 or 4 marathons. I run the Huntington Beach Marathon, the Long Beach Marathon. And while you're running, you're in a zone. And several hours after a long run, you feel very good. But I found that you can't run forever. And you can't play guitar forever. And my body began to break down, and the number of miles I could run per week began to break down. And I just had this nagging feeling that there must be something more. There's a movie, The Fugitive, where Tommy Lee Jones comes to the crash site between the bus and the train, and Harrison Ford supposedly is dead. But Tommy Lee Jones is an expert detective with great intuition. And he looks at the crime scene and he says, you know, something's just not right here. And he goes, I just feel hinky. You know, the hairs on the back of his neck were up. There's just something not right with this accident. And that's the way a lot of people feel before they discover Buddhism. They just have a vague sense of unease. There's something not right. There's something more to life than children, cars, job. And so when I was 38 years old, and this shows how desperate I was, I went on the internet and I came very close to not buying this book, because as a mathematician, I thought that this will be new age garbledygook. It won't work. And this is a little bit of my own, you know, I was in a negative, depressed, frustrated place. I figured this isn't going to work. But I was so desperate and nobody was looking at me. You know, I clicked the mouse and I got this book, and I thought this book was very special and unique, and I bought the one book in the world that could convert Westerners to Buddhism. But I've come to discover that we call it being very ripe to hear the teachings. I was on the very edge of snapping. And so you're very open when you're that frustrated. And when I read this book, within the first chapter, and I tell people that if I was in the audience, I wouldn't believe this story, but I swear it's true. I read this book, and within a couple chapters, I realized that what I was feeling and the way I looked at the world and the way I thought about Christianity is something called Buddhism. It resonated with me, and I kind of thought, oh my gosh, this is what I've been feeling and what I've been thinking, but I didn't know there was a thing out there, a formal thing out there called Buddhism. And basically, the author says in this book, is that our wounds and our suffering and our anger is self-inflicted. It's the problem's not with the external world, it's the problems are coming from within my own mind. It's the way I look at things. And when I was a little boy, my mom used to tell me, if it's everybody else's fault, then it's you. And that's kind of what Buddhism is saying. If it's everyone else's fault, it's you. And I realized at that moment that was my mistake for 30 years. I was looking out, and I wanted others to change and things to be different so that I could be happy. And so I started reading these books at night in my bedroom in secret. And then I became what scholars call a nightstand Buddhist. And this is a really big phenomenon in America. People read these books at night almost as self-help in their bedrooms alone. And it's a good place to start. But you start reading these books and they start to tell you that you really shouldn't study Buddhism at all if you're going to try to study without a teacher. You really can't understand Buddhism through text alone, especially individual by yourself. And so I told my wife, I really think I need to go to a Buddhist temple and find a teacher. And I was kind of half bluffing, but she called my bluff. And she said, okay, let's go this weekend. And so we went to the Orange County Buddhist Church in May of 1999. And my wife was so concerned about me and my dark, gloomy, frustrated attitude towards life that she actually signed us up the next week to be full members of the temple. So nobody does that. No one comes to our church and becomes a member the next week. So there was no turning back. And so I came to this temple, a Japanese school of Buddhism. And then something happened that was kind of interesting. There's two aspects to it. One is every time I felt really warm and welcomed and I felt at home, I would pull back and want to quit. And I think that was me. I think that was me not being able to finally just relax. I finally got to the point where I couldn't help but go. It wasn't a conscious choice anymore. When I went, I felt better. And when I didn't, I felt worse. But another thing that went on that's very prevalent is that I'm also what we call, I have three scholar words for me. The other one they use is a Protestant Buddhist. I'm a Protestant Buddhist. And I can't help it. And I've had people come up to me who say, well, I'm Catholic, and I don't have those Protestant definitions of religion. And I've never said this to them, but they do. They do. They just don't know it yet. A Jewish person could come up to me and say that, and they do too. And Buddhists, Japanese Buddhists, have also been affected by Protestant, this overwhelming Protestant idea of what religion is. And there's nothing wrong with it. But in general, and I speak from experience, I believe that religion was found in texts, in a holy book. And when new people come to our temple, they want to know, what do we read? They want to see our sutra. They want to see the book. What book do you base your religion on? Well, we have a book, but it's not used in that way. They also want to know what morals and ethics we have. What do we believe in? Buddhism doesn't really function in terms of belief. It's not really a belief-oriented type of religion. And the other thing that Protestants do a lot, and this was a lot of these things that Protestants, the buttons they press, was an argument against Catholicism. So Protestants tend to say that the older the writing, the more authentic. Pure Land Buddhism in Japan is relatively a new school of Buddhism. So I thought, well, you know, that doesn't sound like true Buddhism to me. So new people are really worried about true Buddhism, authentic Buddhism, which is a Protestant type. And one analogy I use is, we would never ask if the Beatles' music, is that true rock and roll? I mean, it's way different than Elvis, right? It's not even in America. It's from England. It's foreign. It's not the blues. So, but we would never use that. We would never talk about whether Elvis is true and the Beatles are false. And that kind of argument in religion seems to make sense. But when you apply it to other things, it doesn't apply. And it doesn't really apply to Buddhism. And the other thing that Protestants tend to use against Catholics in the Reformation was a distrust of ritual. Of ritual. And so I come to a Buddhist temple looking for texts. I wanted to trade in the Ten Commandments for the Buddhist version of the Ten Commandments. And nobody gave me... I couldn't make that exchange. I found that very frustrating. I wanted to know, what rules am I supposed to follow and what am I supposed to believe in? And they wouldn't give it to me. And they didn't give it to me on purpose. And I got very frustrated. And the other thing is, there is, at our temple, there's a lot of ritual activity. And the reason why this is true is because the problem is internal and with the mind. Buddhism says that trying to awaken yourself or trying to practice religious practices with the mind as the basis of your practice is like a snake eating its tail. The mind is the problem. There's no way we can rely on the mind to work it out. And another movie is Beautiful Mind with John Nash. No, they tell John Nash, when he has schizophrenia, that there's no way you're going to think your way out of this. And Buddhism is saying, there's no way you're going to think your way out of this. Because it's thinking is the problem. The way you look at things is the problem. And if you try to apply that to this religious question, you'll fail. So what Buddhism tries to do is it uses the body as a back door to affect the mind. And so in Buddhism, meditation is a very important practice. When you sit in silence, we say the mind follows the body. You know, this is the opposite of Descartes. This is the opposite of Western emphasis on all things mental. The body is still, the mind has nothing to do. It goes crazy. But over time, it begins to follow the body and it begins to quiet. It's a back door. Another thing we do is we chant. Chanting is a verbal expression. And a lot of Buddhism, too, is devotional. It's a effective, emotional connection with one's heart to the practice of Buddhism. And this leads me to another point. Buddhism is much more of a path. Western religions tend to be more a religion of power. In general, there's you and there's a savior or an external power. Buddhism is much more of a path or a process. So believing and is not really relevant. It's something you do. It's like learning to dance. I'm a mathematician, and we did lots of homework problems when I was in high school. And you think that the point of doing the math problems is to get the right answer. But the teacher, what did the teacher always say? The teacher always said, you have to show your work. Because, well, I'm going to show my math bias. But mathematicians always say that engineers really care what the answer is. They have books and that formulas and they look things up. They care what the answer is because if they get the answer wrong, the bridge is going to collapse. But mathematicians are more interested on how we arrived at the answer, the process. It's a way of thinking. And you do these problems long enough, and somewhere in my sophomore or junior year of high school, after doing all these problems, I began to think like a mathematician. I was a mathematician. Math was part of me now. It's how I thought. It's how I lived. It's how I viewed the world. And that kind of process goes on with, for instance, dance. My daughter is a musical theater major in high school. It's a high school program. I call her a three-tool player. She has to dance, sing, and act. But when I go to her recitals, a lot of kids, when they dance, they're counting steps. They're counting steps. So for them, dance is something mechanical, something rote, something you memorize. The really good kids, and I'm trying to convince Emily to do this, is you practice so much that the music and the dance becomes part of you, and you begin to move to the music, and your body is expressing the music, and you're actually dancing. You're not counting steps anymore. And that's a lot of what's going on with Buddhism. We have practices that are trying to get us to feel the truth of change or oneness within our hearts. The intellectual understanding is important, but it's not enough. It's a matter of experiencing it in your life. And this experience comes about, this is a little hard to understand in a Western context, but especially Japanese Buddhism, morals and ethics are very, very important. And the rules we follow and conduct in society, all that stuff is very, very important. But it's not considered religious practice. So that's another big difference between Buddhism and other religions. So it's more like saying your ethical behavior is a result of seeing the world properly. So they kind of reverse the arrow. The other thing about why morals and ethics tend to be not considered a religious practice is that, if we're all one and we all have the same essence, then in effect, from a Buddhist point of view, we're all, as we are, enlightened. But we don't see it, and we don't appreciate it, and we haven't experienced it. So Buddhism is trying to have us recognize that truth rather than earning it through purity practices. It's not a matter of making oneself more worthy or being different. It's a matter of stopping, being aware, and just seeing it. I have one analogy I want to show you. Buddhists use beads that we wear on our left hand. And these beads represent the things that we tend to think get in our way. I'm a very impatient person. Now, that can be bad, right? Because I can yell at my kids. But it also can be a very good quality if I'm really dedicated and I have a sense of urgency about Buddhism. That impatience is a good thing. Okay? So from a Buddhist point of view, these things are either good or bad, depending on how we see them. And so in Buddhism, we never get rid of these things. They're always with us. It's a matter of seeing them. So we don't get rid of these personal qualities. And then when we bow, when I first came to Orange County Buddhist Church, I thought we were praying. But the left hand kind of represents the hand of suffering, my life before I went to OCBC. And the right hand, just like in Christian religions, is the good hand. This is the hand of awakening or enlightenment or nirvana. And so when we do this, without getting rid of our personal qualities, there's only one reality. And we either see it as suffering, like I did before I went to OCBC, or I see it as a new meaningful life. And so those two things are put together. We transcend the two-ness of life, and without removing these things, we reach awakening and we bow. Okay? And then this aspect of a process, this is a pair of beads that we have all different sizes. These are the ones we wear just every day as a reminder. I have one on here. These are sandalwood, so it smells really good. These are Bodhi seeds from the Bodhi tree that the historical Buddha achieved enlightenment 2,500 years ago. And this is a big one. These are really supposed to be 108 beads. So this is 108. This is official. But what they do is they'll divide 108 by some fraction. So this one's 27. I think that's 1/4 of 108. There's some that are 18, which I think is 1/6. So you know, this is a little 118 one. This is a 108 one. Now, this one is yellow and clean, and this is the way Bodhi seeds normally look. This one has a caramel patina, and it smells like incense. And the reason why this happened, and these are exactly the same beads. The essence of these two beads are exactly the same. But this mala or ninju, I place on my incense pot at home. And when I burn incense, it naturally imbibes or absorbs the incense smoke. And over time, it's like smoking salmon. Over time, these beads have been transformed by the smoke. And it's a natural process that occurs without any effort. It's inherent in the nature of these beads to absorb smoke. And it doesn't matter whether they're good beads or whether they're bad beads. They will absorb the smoke. Some of the beads on here are not very good. And some of the beads on here are really good. Some have holes in them. But it doesn't matter. They absorb the smoke. And this is the way Buddhists describe listening to the teachings, listening to Dharma talks, going to services, taking part in rituals. From a Japanese Buddhist point of view, we're being transformed. How we view the world, how we think about things, our perspective is being moved and changed by a message of looking at things a different way. And that is the basic religious model behind Buddhism. And it's just different. And so if you come to a Buddhist service and you want to find out when was the Buddha born, what was the name of his horse, what was his mom's name, what garden was he born in, I know the answers to all these questions, but it's not relevant. It's not religiously, it's not relevant. And I've had a lot of 80-year-old Japanese women at our temple. They'll say in an ashamed way that they don't know anything about Buddhism and that they can't win a debate with a Christian. And they actually will get their clock cleaned by a Christian. They will. They'll get destroyed. Because Buddhism for them is not facts. It's not doctrine. It's a way of living and a way of being, and it's a way they dance through life. They're 85 years old and they act like they're 15. They're completely free. One woman at our church, she fell, and she's blind in her left eye now, her left eye. And I came up to her as a minister, and I was going to tend to my flock, and I was going to try to give her some words of encouragement. I mean, she just lost her sight in her left eye. And I couldn't believe it. She said to me, "John, it's so great. My right eye is working so well. I am so lucky that I still have this eye that's working perfectly at 85. I could be blind right now if it wasn't for this eye." And I mean, that is a Buddha. That is somebody who's gone beyond normal ways of thinking. I don't know of very many people that would talk like that. That's an amazing attitude. And she's one of those women who doesn't know anything about Buddhism, because I think she's been influenced by a doctrinal, textual, belief-type definition of religion. And so that's one of my concerns about modern converts, is if they're not open to this other way of looking at religion and they don't stick around enough. You know, it took years for these beads to be turned. And it takes years of Buddhist practice to be turned and to be smoked like this. It takes time. But people come with such high expectations, and they're so impatient that if their life doesn't completely turn around within a month, they quit. So anyway, this is what I tend to focus on when I talk about Buddhism, is if you don't engage it on in its own context, in its own frame of reference, I think you'll fail. And I don't know if I mentioned this, I almost quit the Orange County Buddhist Church after about 2 or 3 years because it didn't match. I couldn't find what I was looking for. I thought Japanese Buddhism wasn't an authentic form of Buddhism because it didn't jive with the books I've read in popular culture. And so it is very dangerous. I mean, it was so profound that I almost quit. So, all right, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. I have one more thing. Sorry. Jeff Wilson is a Buddhist scholar, and he grew up in the UU tradition as a child and a young adult, and I wanted to donate this book to your library. It explains Shin Buddhism but he comes from a UU background, and he's quite well known. And so I thought that that might resonate with you. All right, thank you very much. To be fair, Buddhism also has been, you know, I think religion sometimes gets used. So that has occurred in Japan as well. Buddhists like to kind of brag that maybe not to the extent. I mean, like one thing Buddhists love to bring up is that there were never a Buddhist crusades. That's something that's repeated a lot. And, you know, that I think that is true. But religion has also been used by, you know, the power structure to justify war. And so there has been some of that. Okay. One of the things is in Buddhism, we usually have three or four explanations for everything, but I'll pick the one that I think is... See, Buddhists don't have... Nothing's absolute in Buddhism, so we have to give you four answers, and then you can decide. But I think the real reason, I think, is that the Japanese community was interred during World War II. And we have people at our temple, almost everybody over 60 or 70 was interred in the internment camps during World War II. The Buddhist temples were ransacked. Ministers were put in jail. We have a couple members that were visiting in Japan and got trapped over there during the war. And one woman had shrapnel from Nagasaki, the bomb. So what happened was is the Japanese Buddhist community really tried to homogenize itself and fit in to Western culture. And so if you came to our church, I mean, we have pews and we have an organ and we sing songs and we meet on Sunday and we use the word church. And I think some of it is natural because we're in the West and that's what Westerners do. They go to church on Sunday. But I think that word church was a way of fitting in. I honestly think that's the reason why. So I think it makes sense. But I also think OCBC sounds better than OCBT. But we had a Korean Christian minister come to our church on a weekday and come into the office and just go atomic on one of our Buddhist ministers because he said, you're not allowed to use the word church. You know, you're not Christian. We own that word. And but if we changed it to temple, I'm afraid the rabbis would come. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's just a word. It's just a word. Well, the way I try to explain it is all Buddhist temples believe that it's a path to enlightenment and that everything's impermanent and everything's subject to change and we suffer because we want things to be fixed. And when life doesn't go our way, we're mad. But how to realize that and turn our life around, that varies. The process varies from church to church, from temple to temple. So, you know, my temple, we tend to listen to the teachings and we chant. A Zen temple might sit more. Tibetan would be a lot more ornate rituals. Chinese Buddhism tends to be more eclectic. They do everything. But there's not any doctrinal disputes, per se, like you would think of between Baptists and evangelicals or Calvinists and Catholics. We don't really have any... We don't disagree on the goal. We just have a different way of thinking what's the best way to get there. And one of the analogies I've used is if you want to lose weight, you know, you could run, you could swim. I mean, they're all fine. You're going to lose weight. But what Shin Buddhists try to do, like I said, is they try to find a practice that's very practical. And so if you live in Kansas and I tell you the best way to lose weight is to swim in the ocean or to surf, that's not very... It's not practical. So the different schools, it depends on the audience they're talking to. So that's why we say it's a branch. It's not, the lines between the different groups is fairly blurry. So. Yeah, the lotus is an important symbol for all of Buddhism. And the way we describe it is a lotus flower grows in usually dank, stagnant, icky water. And its roots go down into the stinky mud. But it's able to rise above that and purity, and it floats on top of the water. And so this is kind of analogous to this, is what I'm saying. While still being grounded in the world, you somehow transcend it and radiate. And then the Lotus Sutra is one of the most important sutras in the East. And what happens in the East is different schools focus on different sermons by the Buddha. So the Lotus Sutra is one of those sermons. We focus on a sutra called the Larger Sutra. So different schools in China and Japan focus on different texts. So we tend not to focus on the Lotus Sutra as much. But it's probably, you know, if not, it's one of the most important, if not the most important sutra in the East. But it's a massive work. It's very complex. And you could imagine why a school like Shin, for everyday people, we pick a different style of sermon. Yeah, in our Buddhist tradition, we tend to say there's, you know, many paths to the top of the mountain. And or a more modern way of doing it is there's a lot of different ways to get to San Francisco. And then people think I'm saying that San Francisco is nirvana. But you know, one of the ministers said you could take a plane or a motorcycle, or I don't know if you can take a boat, but you could take a train or a motorcycle or a car. And it's important which vehicle you choose, and you have to stick with it. You have to pick one, and you have to take it all the way. But the destination's the same, and once you get there, it becomes less relevant how you got there. So basically, Buddhism's saying that all the world's religions are pointing to the same thing. It's just that different religions work for different people in different ways. I mean, for my personality and my background, for some reason, Buddhism resonated with me where others didn't. But that doesn't make it better. But it's better for me. And so, like, for instance, I love, my favorite dessert is ice cream. But I don't really think ice cream is quantitatively better than chocolate chip cookies. I mean, I wouldn't argue with someone who said, I like chocolate chip cookies. So that's how we look at it a little bit. It's not like there's one path and we own the truth and if you're not Buddhist, you're doomed to failure. We don't look at it that way. So I would agree with you.